In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about strategies for taking pre-orders for a new product. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 305. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Rob?
Well, it's nice to be in a big city where a lot of musical acts are coming through. And this week, we are seeing not one, but two bands or acts at this club called First Avenue, which is like this icon of Minneapolis. And it was featured prominently in that movie Purple Rain. And I think Prince owned it at one point. So it's kind of this club that's been a club since the 70s. And it's just a very popular club. So anyways, we saw Lauryn Hill, former lead singer of the Fugees, a couple nights ago. And then we're seeing Explosions in the Sky tomorrow. So aside from the same stuff that I've been saying for the past four or five episodes of we're almost done unpacking, that feels like transition is coming to an end, we're hiring several people at Drip and things are moving forward and going pretty well in general. That's the other thing that's new.
You know, when you first mentioned you were going out and seeing a couple of musical acts, my first thought was you're going to get to hear the entire soundtrack for Frozen or something like that.
Yeah, right. I mean, because that's a lot of what we did. Well, not a lot of what we did, but I think that tends to be the default. You know, you get the musical stuff coming through that is kid appropriate. It's easy to bring them. And it's been fun to do some grown-up things too, which kind of the big city really allows that pretty easily.
Cool.
How about you? What's going on?
Well, I'm finally back to normal in terms of my back issues. I don't think I really talked about it on the podcast, but I was kind of out of commission for about a week and a half with a pretty severe spinal problem. So back on my feet now, I can actually stand and walk around without too much trouble and kind of getting back to things and kind of plowing through the work that has been stacking up a little bit. The other thing I do have is a listener sent us an email about an episode we did back in 303, which was our favorite tabletop games. And he runs a company called playtable.xyz. So if you go over to that website, they have essentially it's a tabletop game device that you can put down and you can play tabletop games on it. The focus is on being able to minimize the setup and teardown time for some of the more complicated games and to be able to streamline the rules so that you don't have to go look things up. And it gives a little bit of visual flair to the tabletop games. So I checked it out. They've got a video up and got a mailing list that you can sign up for. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I checked it out as well. I'm intrigued by it. I'd like to see how many games they get on it and how expensive they are and that kind of stuff. But certainly is an interesting workaround instead of having to read all the paper rules all the time. Because that's something I like. Like, you know, we talked about Pandemic a couple episodes ago, and there is a Pandemic for the iPad. And it's really cool because you don't have to remember all the stuff. You just kind of move around and it really helps guide you. I think it's once you know the rules of Pandemic, it's easy enough to play. But like those first couple games are pretty painful just trying to remember everything. And that's what the iPad kind of it's scaffolding that helps you get there faster, basically.
Yeah. Some of those games, it's not even just all the rules. It's all the little markers and stuff that you have to put on the board for all these different things. And then there's special case situations that like an app will just take care of that stuff for you. I think there's a bunch of apps for some of the games that we had talked about. I'm pretty sure there's one for Catan. There is one for Pandemic. There's also one for Small World, which I think was only $6 or $7. But if you buy the board game itself, it's $40 or $50 or something like that.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a huge price difference between them, but you know, it's on an iPad, so it's not as nearly as expensive, but you do get the ability to kind of play against computer opponents. So if you like the game, you can do that.
Yeah, that's nice. Cool. So what are we talking about today?
Today, what we're going to be talking about is how to take pre-orders for a new product. And these are essentially strategies that you can use to go out. And if you have an idea that you're trying to validate or you're trying to get people interested in it and trying to figure out what it is that you actually need to build, then you probably want to get to a point where you're going to be taking pre-orders for that product. And that product can be a piece of software, it can be a book, it can be a service, it can be a course. And depending on how long it takes and what your time investment is going to be, you want to be reasonably sure that people are going to be to pay for it afterwards. So you don't want to spend 6 months or 12 months building something and then try to find people to buy it. I think we talked about it before. James Kennedy at MicroConf Europe had said that sales is really about finding out what people want, going out and getting it, and then delivering it to them. And you kind of have to do it in that order. And if you try to build something and then go find someone to sell it to, you're in a much more difficult situation because now you've already put that time investment in, and it may not have been the right time investment. So taking pre-orders is a step along that process to identify whether or not you're on the right track. So let's talk about some of the motivations for taking pre-orders. And I think the first motivation is risk mitigation. Are you going to be able to find people who are willing to pay for this? Can you convince those people that it's going to solve their problem? And there are a few caveats here, because if you're talking to people individually and one-on-one, it's much easier to sell somebody on the idea than it is if they were to come to your website. But that's also the intent behind this, is you want to have those conversations so you're talking to them directly and you get the feedback about what sorts of hurdles you're going to run into or what questions they have, so that you can use those questions to put on the website that talks about those objection points that they might have.
Yeah, and I think risk mitigation is a really nice benefit of asking for pre-orders. I think there are obviously a lot of different ways to mitigate risk in terms of having a product idea that you don't know if anyone is going to buy. But this is perhaps one of the best. Like, you know, building an email list is another one. Talking to people and getting a verbal commitment is another one. But, you know, until someone actually makes purchase, you don't know for sure if they, in fact, will do it, right? And we've heard people doing it different ways, right? Where you get a check that you're not going to cash, or where you get the credit card and actually charge it and tell them you'll refund it if stuff doesn't work out. But I think this is an intriguing way to do this. And I think that it requires probably a lot of chutzpah to ask for money up front, especially if it's someone you don't know. I think if you tend to know people and they trust you're going to deliver, makes it a little easier. But I do think that doing this is an interesting idea. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past. Like, I have always tended to build the email list rather than actually ask for pre-orders up front, right? Than actually take money. And there's a bunch of logic to that maybe we can cover, you know, in this episode of why I've done that. But at the same time, I do think that, you know, single-handedly risk mitigation may be the single biggest reason that you may want to lean towards actually taking pre-orders.
Actually, let's expand on that a little bit right now instead of trying to talk about it or come back to it later.
Sure.
Because the building the email list, I think in many ways serves as a proxy for asking for money.
Exactly.
And you can use that as there's people that have signed up for my mailing list, and sure, I've got 1,000 people there, but not all of them are going to buy, but some percentage is going to buy.
There you go.
And the question is, what percentage is that? You don't really know. And taking the pre-orders and actually taking somebody's money for it is not even just a proxy for that email list. It is actual money that you've got in your hands that now all you have to do is you have to deliver what it is that they wanted.
Right. And yeah, all those points are valid. The reason I like building an email list is because I can get, you know, let's take Drip, for example. I built the list up to about 3,400 people, and then I was able to kind of nurture them along the process, give them screenshots, give them screencasts, ask for feedback via a survey, eventually do a slow launch and email 300 to 500 people at a time. I mean, it was a very well orchestrated and well crafted thing, and we had a really good conversion rate on that. If instead of building the list, I just had a form that was like, here's this amazing thing, and at the bottom of this page, pre-order Drip for whatever, 3 months for $99 or, you know, whatever price it would have been, I would have gotten, I don't know, 1/100 of the, you know, maybe I would have gotten 50 people or 100 people to pay me. Now, I would have had that money up front and would have had it for sure, but I wouldn't have had the access to all 3,400 people, right? And to be able to, I actually think in the long run, I converted a lot more people to paying, but I had to accept a little more risk up front by not taking the money up front. That makes sense?
Right, but it does, but I don't think that you would use that exact same process for taking pre-orders. I mean, taking a pre-order is not something where you just put up a website and just hope that people buy it sight unseen without any real walkthrough of it. I think that with a pre-order, your strategy is really finding people who really desperately have that problem, and then crafting a solution that specifically solves that, and at the same time having those individual conversations with other people who hopefully overlap to help give you a better sense of what you should actually be building, rather than building stuff, sending it out, doing surveys, and not having as much of a hands-on approach with the people that you're talking to. And I think the strategy that I've seen work and I've used so far with Bluetick, for example, is that if those initial people that you're taking pre-orders from, if you know them or they know you, you can have those one-on-one conversations and establish that rapport with them such that you're able to get the answers to the questions that you really need answered.
Got it. Yeah, so you're talking about doing like medium, high-touch sales to get a handful of pre-orders in essence, like to validate a product. So I think there's a difference. I think we're talking about two different things. And I think those two different things are, you know, you're talking about talking by hand, going through 10 or 15 people and getting those pre-orders to say, all right, it's valid, let's start building it. I'm talking more about later on down the line, having that big list where you actually want to launch and you want to launch to thousands of MRR right off the bat. But I think our two approaches that we're talking about are actually most powerful when they're combined. And let me let me talk through that real quick. I do think that validating, you know, so the way I validated Drip was I emailed a bunch of people. By a bunch, it was 17. And I got verbal commitments via email. Yes, if you deliver that, I would try it out for 3 months. That's all it was. I didn't actually take pre-orders. Now, why didn't I take pre-orders? Well, two things. One, I knew that it could easily be 6 months from that time until we finished the product because Derek was part-time on it. There was just a bunch of stuff and I didn't know how long it would take. It didn't feel cool to me to take people's money and to just sit on it for that long. Number two, all the people I was emailing with had some relationship with me. And so I trusted that if they actually said that they would try it out, that they would try it out. And in the end, there were 11 people that said yes, and almost all of them, I think 9 or 10, took me up on it and did deliver. Now, your mileage may vary there. You know, if you're at a conference and you're meeting brand new people and you don't know them, it's like, how much is their verbal commitment worth? You don't know. So I do think there's some things to think about there. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer here. I really do think that you have to kind of ask yourself what situation you're in. Now, I have seen people multiple times when they go to take pre-orders, they do it on a landing page where they send you to a site that looks like a landing page or a SaaS marketing site type thing. And they say, the product's not ready. Enter your credit card here. We'll charge you $49 and you'll get the first X months free. And that's the approach I mentioned. And that's, I think what we're both saying is you probably don't want to do that. I actually think that's a really bad approach. And the reason is because of what I said earlier of if you can build a list of a couple thousand people and then get pre-orders from there, you're going to be way better off, right? It's to combine the two approaches and nurture that list until you're getting close to when the product will be ready. And then you've shown them screenshots, you've shown them through Incast, you've got them interested in the product. And then before the product is ready, but you're kind of like, you know, I think it'll be done in the next month type thing or the next few weeks. Then you come in and say, look, I'm going to give you this awesome deal, you know, buy your first year or your first 6 months for XYZ. They've already seen the screenshots. They know it's pretty close anyways. And then that's when you're going to make that big initial push. And I think you get quite a bit of revenue. But you're no longer really validating the idea. I mean, I guess you're validating all the way to product market fit if we were to take it literally, but you do at least know that there's some desire for it. At this point, you really are trying to kind of maximize some early revenue and get momentum going.
Yeah, and I think the two approaches, as you said, are they're very complementary and they overlap quite a bit. I don't think that you either do one or the other, but you are probably not going to be in a position where you can gather 1,000 or 2,000 emails without having a pretty solid idea of what it is that you're offering, what problem that you're solving. So that's really where some of these strategies for taking the pre-orders really helps, because you can have those individual conversations. You can use that to kind of craft what it is that you're going to be building, the marketing messages around it, the specific pain points that you're trying to solve, and then use that information to go out and help build your mailing list. And at the same time, then you're building it and you've kind of validated, hey, I've got enough people here that have placed a pre-order for it. And in parallel, you're also trying to build that mailing list using that information. And I think you can build a mailing list without it. You can kind of, I don't want to say guess, but it is, I'll say taking educated guesses about what it is that people really want or need and having a few conversations here and there to help make sure that you're on the right track.
Yeah. And I think another benefit to doing this kind of hybrid approach we're talking about, where you do get validation up front from a smaller number of people and, you know, maybe take pre-orders, maybe you don't, based on what you want to do, and then building that mailing list, launching to it, and potentially also taking a second round, essentially, of pre-order right before you're ready to launch. There's another benefit to that in that you can then start trying out paid media when you're building that list, right? And you can try Facebook ads and AdWords and whatever else. You can also try content marketing. You try SEO. You can do a bunch of stuff that is that more broad, wider funnel marketing rather than just all the one-on-one stuff that would be required if you really have to talk to everyone who's going to buy from you.
I think one of the other motivations for accepting the pre-orders is that it allows you to fill in some of the knowledge gaps in terms of who exactly is your target customer, what do they do, what's their role. And this comes back to having those individual conversations with people, and it allows those one-on-one conversations let you find out what you think is important that the customer actually doesn't care about. And it's very easy to think that something needs to be done when the customers actually don't care about it. It might be cool, it might be interesting to see, but it's not something that is really a big deal. And then the reverse of that can also be true. You might think that, oh, this small feature over here is a nice to have, and then customers see it and they realize how powerful it is, and suddenly, like, that's the thing that they really are looking for. And you didn't necessarily realize right away that that was so important to them. And they may not have either, but in seeing it, it can change their mind and it can make them see things in a different light.
Other knowledge gaps you can fill in are, you know, what is important to buyers that you don't know about. how much are people willing to pay versus what you think they're willing to pay or what you think your app is worth. There are a lot of questions early on when you're building an app. And I think that getting someone to put money down, this is essentially another form of risk mitigation. And it's a form of learning early on, even before you have a product.
Yeah, and we'll talk specifically about what people are willing to pay versus what you think it is a little bit further in this episode. Yeah, I mean, those are all very important parts. So those two motivations for taking the pre-orders are just the risk mitigation and then helping to fill in the knowledge gaps. So let's talk very, very briefly about how to actually take somebody's money for when you're doing pre-orders. There's three different ways that I know of. The first one that I've done is using WordPress and WP Simple Pay Pro and Stripe. So it's very easy to obviously set up a WordPress site. There's a plugin made by Phil Dirksen. It's called WP Simple Pay Pro. You can buy it, I think it's $40 or $50 or something like that. It's not very expensive. And then you wire it up to a Stripe account and you can take pre-orders. And you can even refund people's money through Stripe months later, whether it's 6 months or 7 months later. It appears to not be a big deal through Stripe. Now, of course, their credit card still has to be active, but you can do that. And because Stripe hooks into your bank account when depositing the money, they're able to turn around and take that money back out of your account, assuming that no more money is coming into the Stripe account. The other two mechanisms that I've seen are Gumroad and Send Owl. Both of these are mechanisms for typically delivering digital assets over the internet. Both Gumroad and Send Owl allow you to set up a pre-order mechanism that allows you to distribute things once you've taken a pre-order. One thing I don't know about either of these is whether or not you can go back and charge them in the future, like on a subscription basis. So it may not be the best option if you're selling like a SaaS application, but if you're selling like an info product or a training product or a book of any kind, those are pretty reasonable options. Because then once you've finished it, you can upload it and then get it distributed to people very, very quickly.
Another option here is there's an iOS app. I'm assuming there are Android apps as well, but I'm just looking in iTunes right now. There's an iOS app called Payment for Stripe, and you can hook this into your Stripe account. You could potentially, you know, if you're at a conference or kind of anywhere, you could be talking to folks in person and pretty easily take pre-orders. And I think that's a nice way to do this if you don't want to do it over the web and you want to do something more in person.
So when you're doing one-on-one demos with people, what is it that you really need to show them? And for something like a course or a training product, you probably want to give them a course outline. If it's a book, you probably want to give them a table of contents and outline all the different topics that you're going to cover. If it's software, you most likely want to have screen mockups of some kind. And what I would do is I would walk through all the important parts of the application that are going to solve the problem. You don't need to put in every screen. So things like profile screens and administration screens, you most likely don't need those. You really want to focus on the screens that are going to solve their problem. And I would wire up as much as you possibly can in a way that makes it obvious where they're supposed to go and what they're going to do and how they're going to solve the problem that software is designed to solve. And there's a lot of different tools and wireframing products out there that you can use. Balsamiq is one that I've used pretty extensively. I've also seen people use Envision app, and there's, I don't know, probably half a dozen others as well. But you can put these together and you can spend as much or as little time on these things as you want. I mean, it's like any software product, you know, that you're going to get out of it what you put into it. But at some point you have to draw the line and say, yes, this is good enough. And I think that's a very important piece to remember, is that you don't have to make everything look pretty. The final design does not have to be there. You're really trying to focus on the problem that you're solving and showing to the person that you're going to give that demo to that this product is going to solve that problem.
Yeah, that's the key thing to remember is when I did pre-orders for Drip, I actually didn't show any screenshots. I do think it's helpful if you are a designer, you can do decent mockups to show some. But I think that if you get too far into the weeds, people frankly don't necessarily have the time to dig into it. I think building a landing page and a marketing page for it with just a bunch of copy and, you know, maybe a fake screenshot, not even as something you're going to distribute, but just as something that you can email to folks as you're emailing or as you're talking through, or even just a short slide deck, like 5 slides of what you think things might look like. But I think you should focus, as you said, more on you got to figure out that value proposition. And that value proposition could almost be communicated in one sentence or a sentence plus a few bullets. And if that's what resonates, then what you're actually going to build can come later. You're just trying to figure out, is there a problem here that needs to be solved? And like, what is the general way that I'm going to solve that? And I think the earlier in the process that you can figure that out and that you can get confirmation that really resonates with people, where they're not kind of puzzled like, yeah, I guess that's it. But where they're like, oh my gosh, yes, this is such a big pain point. That's really what you're trying to get to.
The other thing to keep in mind when you're going through that is that your value proposition that you communicate people is likely going to change probably dramatically between the first 2 or 3 or even 5 people. So you're going to iterate on that value proposition and your sales pitch after each person that you talk to, because you're going to get feedback. There are going to be certain things that resonate with them. And the future conversations that you have, you're going to want to take those and extract things that you've learned from earlier conversations and present it to them and see if that works with them. So you're sort of split testing the information that you're learning with the other people that you're giving the demo to. And I don't know, as I would just say, oh, give a demo to 5 or 10 people. You want to give it to as many as you can. I would probably shoot for at least a, you know, probably 15 or 20 if you can do that. But realistically, you also want to run your idea past probably more than that. Probably 30 or 40 people is probably a good ballpark number of people to run the idea past. And then in terms of the demos, you probably want to give at least a dozen of them so that you can start honing in on the specific pieces that the majority of the people feel are important to them. And then you can concentrate on understanding what features need to be built first and what is the most important to people, and categorizing them according to what things need to be built first and what things can be pushed, what things are not important and just can go into a future version.
Is this similar to the process that you've been following for Blue Tick?
It is, actually. Most of it is. For example, I didn't take orders through Gumroad or Sendowl. I took them using WordPress and the WP Simple Pay Pro. And then one thing that we haven't talked about yet, I did say that we'd come back to it, which was talking to people about actually taking the sale and taking their money for it. What I did for this piece was, what I wasn't sure of was how much people were willing to pay for it. I had in my mind that I wanted to charge people $50 per mailbox for it, but I wasn't sure whether or not that would be appropriate. What would people feel like the product was going to be worth to their business based on the problems that it solved? So when I explained to them, I said, hey, here's what my process is, and I may or may not actually go through with this, but if I take your money now and I decided not to go through with it, then I'll refund it. So I laid out my refund policy. I laid out exactly what my timetable was, and I told them, look, I'll take your money now. I'm probably not going to be able to deliver for at least 4 to 6 months. And even after that point, it may still not work for you for another 3 or 4 months after that. So it could be upwards of 8 or 9 months before I have something that I'm able to deliver to you. But with that said, if 8 months down the road, you say, hey, this isn't working for me, or I've gone in a different direction, I'm more than happy to give you a refund and I'll eat whatever transaction costs. If I have to send it through to you through PayPal, I'm more than happy to do that. What I'm really interested in now is, does this actually solve a problem for you that you're willing to pay for? Going back to the naming a price, this is a piece that I wasn't real sure about. And so I was very careful and cautious about presenting it to people in such a way that I wanted them to name what they felt it was going to be worth to their business. So when I did that, I said, you're going to put your credit card number in, and the website that I connected it to, I literally had a text box there and they had to type in the amount. So I would send them the URL through Skype and they could plug in that number, and I would ask them to prepay for a certain number of months. And it defaulted to 3, but they could select anywhere between 1 and 6. And I've had a recent conversation with somebody, and they thought that by and large, everyone would just choose 1 month. But the reality is, what I found was, out of the dozen people that I took pre-orders from initially, there was one person who prepaid for 1 month, there were two people who prepaid for 2 months, and then 9 people who prepaid for 3 months. So it was very interesting to see that most of them prepaid for either the default or at least a little bit. And I think that that was because they had this understanding that, hey, I'm not going to get a ton of value out of this upfront. It's more of a longer-term investment, which is really what I was looking for, because that validates and qualifies the people who are signing up for pre-orders. They're looking at it as a longer-term investment. They're looking at it as something that they're going to be using for a while, as opposed to somebody who's a tire kicker who's on your mailing list and it does not have the level of investment or intended investment that you desire as the person who's creating the product. I will say, for sure, that the first couple of conversations that you have with people, and this is especially true on the first conversation where you're asking for that pre-sale, is when you ask them and say, hey, this is what it looks like. Would it solve your problem? If they say yes, say, great. Well, here's a web page I'm going to give you. Here's what the refund policy is, timeline, etc., when you will be charged for it the next time. What I did for people was I took the payment that they had and I said, I will apply that as a credit to your account, but only after you have told me that it's going to provide value to you. And I think that there's a few different ways you can structure when they're going to start paying for the application that you're delivering or the product that you're delivering. But if it's a SaaS application, you kind of have three options. You can either have them start being charged when they're first onboarded, a specified time after onboarding. So let's say you onboard them on the 1st of January. You can say, okay, you get it for X number of months, whatever you've prepaid for, and then I will start charging you immediately. Or maybe you give them a 90-day grace period because you know that when you first get them onboarded, there's probably going to be issues. So maybe you give them a little bit of an extended runway there. Or what I did, which I think may have been a mistake, was to say, I'm not going to charge you until it provides value. In retrospect, I think that that was a mistake because it kind of gives people an unlimited time window, which they can push it lower on their priority list. So one of the challenges I've run into is people just aren't really making time for using the app. And I think that if you were to say, look, after I've onboarded you, I won't charge you for 60 days, but once that point hits, then the clock will start. And if you set that expectation up front, then you can always extend it. You can always say, look, we delivered this. We're not quite ready yet. We know that there's some issues or things that we need to implement for it to really provide value. So we're going to push this timetable out. If you're trying to dial things back in, if you're trying to reel them in, you're almost taking things away from them. And it's not really fair to do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a good way to think about it. You know, obviously, I've talked about this, but with Drip, I basically had let people have unlimited trial because I was working so closely with them. This was for the first, let's say, maybe 20 customers when I was essentially doing, you know, it was the early access and we were just kind of onboarding and trying to get features done. And the hard part that I had is certain people would say, once I have X and Y, then I'm willing to pay. And sometimes X and Y took us a month to build. I didn't want anyone's trial to be expiring during that time. So that's why I was telling people, look, once it provides value, then let's call it and start charging. But I think you make a good point, is there's always not a real impetus for them to dig in and do a time investment there. So I think this is another place where kind of have to use your judgment.
The other piece that factors into that is that if you, let's say that you signed up, call it 10 people for easy math there, and three of them come back to you with stuff that's going to take a month to build. Well, in order to deliver all three of those things, it's going to take 3 months to probably deliver it. So it kind of pushes your entire timetable back for all kinds of things. And some of them you may not have realized up front that those things really needed to be built in order to provide value to everybody. So if you dial back those expectations a little bit and say, look, you know, you've prepaid for 3 months, I'm going to give you a month and a half or 2 months up front just to kind of get comfortable with it. And then I will start applying the credit. Again, it just goes back to being able to extend things out if you need to, or if problems come up and you need to push things out and say, look, I know we were going to charge you now, but we're not going to. We're going to push this out because we're not ready yet. We can't deliver on this yet, and it's not fair to you.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to handle it.
The other thing that I did, as I mentioned before, about naming the price and letting the customer pick their price, is that it gives you a solid sense of what people are actually willing to pay versus what you think that they're willing to pay. And I think that this is super important, because if you are too far off in what you think that the product is worth, let's say that you think that people are going to pay $100 a month for it, and they come back to you and they say, yeah, I might pay $35 or $40 for it, but $100 is just way too much. You might step back and say, well, do I really want to go forward and build this product when my lifetime value is going to be less than half of what I thought it was going to be? And assuming that somebody paying $50 a month would stick around the same amount of time as somebody paying $100 a month, your lifetime value is going to be half for those people. So the issue is, can you justify building the product at that price point and selling it at that price point? Are you going to be able to acquire customers at that price point? If you are talking to somebody and you name a price, their mind is instantly anchored to that price as opposed to what they think it's going to provide to them in value. So there may be a disconnect between people who don't know who you are or what the story is behind it and just hit your website versus those people you're talking to individually, and you can kind of convince them that, hey, this is a justifiable price for reasons X, Y, and Z. You can't have that conversation with somebody who just hits your website.
Yeah, you know, since pricing is such a hard thing to nail down and there is so much guesswork and risk in it, I really liked the conversations that I had early on validating Drip. I think this is really important. And I also think something you need to think about is, if you're just getting started, it can be okay to have a lower price product that you're going to learn on. I mean, I think of how I stair-stepped up and went from one-time sales and then to subscriptions with Hittail, and it was, what, $9 starting point. It was like $9.95 and $20 and $40 and $80. And then at a certain point, I saw like how bad the churn was, and you know, there were just limitations of how much I could grow it. And then beyond that, it was like, well, let's get aspirational, right? I mean, that the original pricing of Drip was $99 a month. That was going to be the minimum. And I was kept saying, like, what do we have to build to make this product worth $99 a month? I think that can be an interesting question. question if you're far enough along that it makes sense to do. But I also don't, you know, I think you can toy with lower end price points, just know you're going to have more churn and stuff like that.
So I think the last step in this process is once you have decided whether or not you're going to move forward or abandon the product that you're looking at launching, I think you need to let everybody know. You need to let them know whether it's a mass email or individual emails. If you decided to move on and go do something else because it doesn't look like you're either going to be able to deliver or that the product is going to be radically different than what you had envisioned and it's not something that you want to pursue, then you're going to want to go back and refund everybody's money and maybe look at either a related product or try something completely different. But regardless of what that is, you need to let people know early enough in the pre-order process, especially when you have them on the phone or you're talking to them and you're giving them that demo, set their expectations and you can tell them, hey, I'm doing this with X number of people, or you can just ballpark it and let them know, I expect to know within 30 days, for example, that whether or not I'm going to move forward with this. And at that point, if I don't have enough people or haven't gotten enough momentum with this, I'll refund your money. So just make sure that you let them know what you're going to be doing at that point. And if you've made a commitment to them, you're going to let them know by a certain date, follow through with that. And once you've done that, make sure to keep in touch every 4 to 6 weeks to let them know how things are going, what new developments are going on. If you can include screenshots and keep them posted on how different pieces of the application are going, if you're ahead or behind in any areas, the more information that you can tell them about how close you are to the original timeline that you expected, the better off you're going to be and the more invested that they're going to be in the application when they finally get onboarded. And you're going to help generate that excitement with them.
I think this part can't be underscored enough. When you have someone's money, they tend to want to see some results from it. And you can either make it kind of a crappy experience for them where you're not communicating with them very well. And that would tend to be a lot of our defaults. You know, as a developer, your head's down, you want to build stuff. Or an entrepreneur, you know, if you have other developers and you're not, you're going to tend to not communicate enough. But I think there's a really nice approach here to be able to get people excited about this, and then they get thinking, and then they get talking about it, and then they tell other people. And what we saw with Drip was there were people in early access who started talking in their mastermind groups and in their little private Slack channels and their private forums. And I started getting direct emails from people saying, hey, so-and-so's talking about this. You know, whether we had early access folks like Brennan Dunn and Jeff from Ambassador and Ruben from BitSketch. And they'd say, you know, Ruben mentioned this. This sounds like something I need. Can I get in on it? And so I then had people asking to get in early access before we launched. It was crazy, right? And that's the type of thing that you want to be able to build. It's not as hard as it sounds. I don't think this is lightning in a bottle Cinderella story stuff. This is just kind of following this playbook and building something that people really are interested and need, and that it really does, you know, solve a pain point for them.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because if somebody comes to you and specifically asks to be on that early access program, there's nothing saying that you can't put them into it. Let's say you've got the initial 12 people signed up and you're working through the pre-order process with them, and maybe you've delivered an alpha version to them. There's nothing saying that you can't take more pre-orders and put them through that process and start onboarding those people. I've actually done that to some extent, but it's also got to be somebody who I feel is going to be a good fit for it and is going to start using it right away, as opposed to somebody who is more of a tire kicker, I'll say.
Totally. I feel the same way. I also added people late. I did confirm with them. I was like, if you're really ready to dive in, let's do this. There's not a lot of time, so I added a little bit of time pressure. And I also started implying by that point, since I'd had enough experience with folks getting started up on Drip, I did tell them, hey, you know, I'm going to give you as much time as you need for a trial, but it's going to tend to be between 20 and 30 days when you're really going to hit the ground running. So I kind of level set an expectation of you can't just surf on this thing for 90 days and expect to see results.
Yeah, and as they're going through that onboarding process, it helps you pave over some of the rough points of the app, whether there's documentation issues or pieces that are not entirely clear because the UI or the UX is not well designed, or you just haven't quite figured out how to present information in a way that makes it easy for the user to understand. I mean, there's lots of those types of issues that as you're going through the early access pieces of it, you're going to be aware of those, and you can point people specifically to different things, or you can create videos that you send somebody so that you maybe don't get to a point where you don't have to onboard each person individually. And that's really the position you want to be leading up to the point where you leverage your mailing list and start doing a much more public launch.
That wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsoftherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsoftherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.